Welcome to All Sides. They knew it was coming one way or another. Big cuts in state funding to local school districts. Some are hurt more than others, including a slew of Central Ohio districts hit with double-digit cuts this year alone. Later on, we'll hear from Dr. Michael Johnson. He's superintendent of the Bexley City School District and also the executive director of the Ohio Association of School Business Officials will be joining us. Right now, we welcome Columbus Dispatch public affairs reporter Jim Siegel to the show for our usual primer on the topic. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you. Good to be here.
$780 million in cuts over 2 years for Ohio's 612 school districts in total. In your story this week, you put it this way, when the dust settled. So it makes you wonder, has it been unclear until this week?
This has definitely been a more difficult budget to determine exactly where schools were going to land than a typical budget. Typically in a budget, you worry about the per pupil funding formula, where they're going to distribute the money. And once you get that settled, and that often changes several times during the process, but once that's settled, you can usually follow it along pretty easily. But this year, because of a couple different factors, it made it tougher. One, there was the federal stimulus money from the last school year. Schools got about $450 million in federal stimulus money that disappeared at the end of the year. It wasn't, the feds didn't come back with another federal stimulus package, so they did not get that money. And there was a question all along of how do you account for it? Do you account it or not? And the administration and even the legislature at times were putting out spreadsheets on district by district spreadsheets that were not accounting for that money being lost.
Just ignoring it.
Right.
Okay.
And they would argue, well, they knew this money was going away. I said, well, knowing the money's going away doesn't mean that they still don't feel the effect. So we had to keep trying to add it back in and it made it a little tougher to track. And even more complicated this time, the administration decided, they were going to cut schools, but they weren't going to do it through the per pupil formula. They didn't cut the per pupil formula. They actually increased funding there. Instead, what they did was they cut funding that schools were getting in reimbursements for taxes that had been eliminated over the years, tangible personal property taxes, which are essentially a local tax on businesses, on their inventory and equipment. This was long been a this was long considered a bad tax in Ohio. It was a tax that harkened back to our days of great industry, and we got a lot of money out of this tax. Obviously, when you're manufacturing. Base is strong. You get a lot of money out of an inventory and equipment tax. But over time, it was determined that was making us uncompetitive, so they got rid of that tax starting in 2005, and it's actually starting a little earlier for utilities.
Right.
But schools were supposed to be held harmless, so they didn't lose all this money that they were collecting from that tax. But this budget, instead of keeping them where they were supposed to be, it started to accelerate quickly, reducing that what schools were getting in that tax reimbursement, and that made it a little tougher to figure out, okay, exactly what is the impact this time on schools, because that was kind of a different area of the budget we hadn't necessarily had to deal with here.
What's the benefit to the state's bottom line to phase out or accelerate the phase out of those reimbursements? How does that help the state's bottom line? If they're eliminating, they're phasing out the reimbursement, does that mean the tax money that the schools would have gotten are just going to the general revenue fund?
Yes, that's exactly what it means. The commercial activities tax, which is the tax that Republicans implemented in 2005 as part of their tax reform plan, this is the gross receipts tax on business. 70% of that tax was earmarked for schools to make up for the loss of the tangible personal property tax. Mm-hmm. So what happens is if you don't – and so when you were to look at the budget documents, the commercial activities tax, also known as a CAT tax, it wouldn't even show up in GRF money. Because it wasn't being used in GRF, it was automatically being earmarked for schools. But now because of the way – now so basically you take some of that back from the schools and you can put it into the general revenue fund, and that will – it basically gives them more money to spend.
And when they changed the law, by the way, my guest is Jim Siegel, public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about school funding cuts, $780 million in cuts over 2 years for Ohio's 612 school districts. How are they going to manage this? That's what we're talking about today. If you have an idea of how to manage it for your school district, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go onto the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and talk to us there. So this was a promise that was made back in probably 2001, 2002, something like that, when they were first talking about eliminating these taxes?
Yeah, I think actually for the tangible personal property, I think it was 05. Okay. Now, and this is where, it got confusing. The law was set up so that the hold harmless payments to schools were supposed to start phasing out, I believe, in 2013, and then they were going to phase out till 2019. So some Republicans, including the governor's office, were making the argument, look, these schools knew this payment was going to phase out, so they should have been ready for it. And yeah, we're going to do it a little earlier than we said we would, but this shouldn't be a total shock. But schools said, wait a minute, yes, the law does say these payments, the hold harmless payments, were going to phase out. But the law also says that 70% of CAT tax revenue will come to schools forever. So what they would argue is, yeah, maybe we weren't going to get it under the same formula we got it before, but we were still going to get that money. There was no expectation that we were going to lose CAT tax money through these reimbursements. They may lose the reimbursement formula rate, but they weren't going to lose the money. And they basically said, no, we shouldn't have expected that. And that's where the cuts, they felt they were a little blindsided by those cuts.
Now, the school funding formula itself, did that change?
It did. Former Governor Ted Strickland implemented a broad overhaul of school funding 2 years ago in his budget. And it was called the evidence-based model. It tried to cost out certain components of education. But Governor Kasich came in, and as promised, he pretty much scrapped what Governor Strickland had done, has kind of rebuilt a new formula. Now, this is Governor Kasich admitted right off the bat. He said, "Look, this is what I'm doing now is a bridge formula. This is just supposed to be temporary until I can work with people around the state and craft something a little more permanent." Basically, what he did was he put in a formula that tried to direct more money to poorer schools, to schools that rely more on state money than maybe some wealthier districts. In general, the legislature made some tweaks to that because some of the wealthier suburban districts were really complaining loudly that they were getting hammered. So they did add some more money that mostly went to to some of the wealthier schools that were seeing the biggest percentage cuts.
Except they cloaked it in cloak may not be the right word, but they put it into the form of a reward, $17 per student reward for achievement tests.
Yes, that was part of it. They did put money directly into the formula.
Okay.
They added, I think the House and the Senate combined added about $160 million back into the formula after they got some
for the wealthier districts.
Right. I mean, it wasn't all for wealthier districts, but the majority of it was, because they basically said, look, we're trying to help the districts seeing the biggest cuts, and on a percentage basis, the wealthier schools were seeing the biggest cuts under the governor's initial budget. But yeah, you're right. There was also a performance bonus where districts that are rated excellent or excellent with distinction will get $17 per student. It's an estimate that that's probably going to be about $30 million over 2 years. It's not a lot of money. And reports have shown that's about two-thirds of that will go to wealthier schools just based on they just happen to be the ones in general that are rated excellent or better.
Just by chance.
Just by chance.
Bill and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hey, Jim, how should schools react to temporary money? And you can name the temporary money, whether it's stimulus or not. Considering the fact that, 80% of a school's budget is for salaries, should they spend it? Should they earmark it for one-time expenditures? Should they save it? What should they do?
Well, that's a good question. It's probably something that each district would have to answer itself. I mean, a lot of the districts, and when you go back 2 years ago when Ohio got billions in federal stimulus money, the governor's office pumped over a billion of that into education. And a lot of that money was supposed to be used just for basic operations. This was not a You know, this was not built in as, hey, we use this for one-time expenditures. The plan was this is to help, you know, keep your teachers employed, keep your lights on. And it's tough, though. I mean, when you know you've got one-time money, it's tough to, you know, obviously if you're using it for operational expenses, it's going to go away and you're going to have to try to figure out what to do next. Some schools did save money. There was a second pot of stimulus money that came in. A jobs, I'm forgetting the exact name of it. It was the jobs. It had jobs in the name.
Federal Education Jobs Fund money.
Yes, Federal mm-hmm. Education Jobs Fund. And that's about schools did save that money, almost $300 million of that out of more. I forget exactly the number they got total, but they saved almost $300 million, and that they can use to help offset some of the cuts this year.
Thank you, Bill, for that call. So it's about $290 million in unspent Federal Education Jobs Fund money. Mm-hmm. Did the state save it or did the district save it?
The district saved
but
it.
But not all districts were able to save it.
Not all, but most. I believe that I want to say it's almost 85-90% of the money went unspent because this money came in and a lot of schools said, okay, we've already got our budget set, so let's just bank this money and hold on to it because we know that coming next year it's going to be a lot worse, and in fact it is.
You wrote that this budget means that many school districts will go 4 to 8 straight years without even inflationary increases in state operating funds. This is just a 2-year state budget, so you're looking backwards.
If you go back, I guess, you know, if you go back to the last two-year budget under Governor Strickland, the total funding for schools was cut by like 0.25% each year. This year it was cut like about 8% the first year and 3% the second. But if you go back to the Governor Strickland's first budget, the increases were about 2 to 3% a year, but there were a number of districts that got no increase in that budget. You go back the budget before that, Governor Taft's last budget, again, small increases total. A number of districts didn't see any increases or saw very small state increases. So, you know, when you talk about the cuts in this budget, one thing to remember is this is not just a 2-year issue for a number of districts. This is a problem that has been compounded for a number of years. It's been quite a dry spell for some that when it comes to state funding, and they've been forced to try to find other ways to raise money.
Right. The old-fashioned way, of course, is to levy taxes. Mm-hmm. And the governor has said he does not want school districts to levy or to increase their levies at this point in response to this.
Right. Yeah, that's what he wants. And the school districts, and I'm sure you'll hear from our guests here later that's probably an unrealistic request. Even when school funding was going up at a better rate, then, you know, schools still went to the ballot. Now the governor is arguing, look, you know, you need to adjust salaries, you need to adjust benefits, you need to do things to adjust your budgets in order to, you know, to keep the people you need and provide the education you need to provide. Schools, of course, will tell you it's not as easy as it sounds.
And that's what is the point you're making, is that's what they've been doing for the last 6 to 8 years, is adjusting.
Well, they've been adjusting to some degree by choice. Although what the governor will argue is, look, the salary schedules continue to raise salaries at a rate that and raise benefits at a rate that we can't sustain. The public can't pay for it. So, like I said, then, you know, I know if I mention Senate Bill 5, we'll start. We don't want to go too far down that road, but that's part of what he's talking about. Collective bargaining changes. He wants to see that. He wants to see that upheld in November. You know, things like teacher merit pay, teacher evaluations. He thinks can help with some of that. Not having to keep not having to when it comes time for layoffs, not having to lay off only the newest teachers, being able to lay off teachers based on other factors besides seniority. So he's hoping that will help save money. Districts will tell you that even if all that stayed in place and was implemented, in 2 years it's probably too much to ask to save that kind of money.
To have that incorporated and to see the benefits of that.
Right.
So at the very, very least, there's a 2-year period here that they're going to have to suck it up or ask the taxpayers for more money.
Right.
My guest is Jim Siegel. He's public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. He's going to stay with us this hour. If you have a question or comment for him about school funding a la the state budget, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do you think? Would you rather see your school district suck it up and not raise taxes, or are you willing to pay a little bit more to make up the difference in the loss to your district from state funding? You can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you want to do that. We're hoping we're getting the superintendent for Bexley City Schools coming up next. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and time is running out on your opportunity for a Chefs in the City coffee brunch at Deepwood Restaurant. The event is Saturday, July 23rd, and includes a local gourmet brunch and a Luck Brothers coffee tasting. Visit WOSU.org/chefs for tickets. And stay with us later today at 1. On Point begins with a discussion of the deficit, taxes, and the middle class. That discussion on Point at 1 o'clock this afternoon.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. The 2011 Jazzoo series continues this Friday, July 15th with Broadway Meets Hollywood, featuring Helen Welch at the Columbus Zoo. Gates open at 6:30 with show at 8. Tickets and details at jazzartsgroup.org.
74 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today will get up to a high of 82. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 63. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, we're talking about state cuts to public education. Joining us right now, Jim Siegel. He's a public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We're trying to get a hold of the Bexley superintendent to no avail at this point, sadly, but you never know. Stranger things have happened. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You can tweet us at Ann Fisher WOSU2 if that is your preferred mode. We're talking about state cuts to public education. What do you think? Would you rather pay higher taxes and help the district over this hump without cutting teacher pay, without cutting teachers from the budget, without making other cuts in personnel and classroom supplies or not? 614-292-8513. David Varda is going to be on the show coming up. He is the executive director of the Ohio Association of School Business Officials. He told you that $780 million may be better than anyone expected. Do you know what he was talking about?
Well, initially, they had tried to prepare schools for cuts that could have ranged anywhere from 15 to 20% over the 2 years. Now, I don't know if there was ever an expectation that the cuts would get that bad, but that's when lawmakers and the governor talked about it before the budget was introduced, those were some of the numbers that were being thrown around. Now they got revenues started to come in better than expected, so that helped, and they did some other things. So it is a little unusual to say that you're getting cut by that amount of money, and we didn't fare as bad as we thought, but considering the budget situation, the budget hole they had to fill. The feeling is that it could have been worse.
Joining us now is Dr. Michael Johnson. He's superintendent of the Bexley City School District. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
You're facing a 15.7% cut this year and another half a percentage point cut next year. Were you surprised by those numbers? Were you bracing for it already or already actually making cuts to accommodate the change?
Well, in our five-year forecast, we had forecasted salary increases of a higher amount, and we anticipated the cuts and entered into negotiated agreements with our teacher organization and our OPSI organization. So the money that we would have had for raises, we can't offer. So everybody agreed to zero increases in the base salary, and the equivalent in our five-year forecast, that's equivalent to the loss in revenue.
How much do you attribute the concessions to Senate Bill 5, the law that's now being contested on the ballot in November that would have changed collective bargaining rights for public employees?
There's probably some element of that that contributed to the settlement. I think more was just the anticipated loss in revenue, but I don't know how much the Senate Bill 5 contributed to the settlement, but I'm sure it had some effect.
Are layoffs expected?
No. We've been managing our budget with attrition moves, so if enrollment goes down in an area, we won't rehire after a resignation or retirement. And so we have been reducing staff over the last several years through that mechanism.
The average student-teacher ratio in Bexley, according to your website, is 16 to 1, but parents have been concerned lately about class size. In Bexley, there were some parents of fourth graders that were quoted recently. Some are worried about classes as large as 27 and 27 students to one teacher. The board president, I believe, said, well, that's the superintendent's call. So, well, lucky you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the policy defines how many teachers and staff that we have based on the enrollment. So we're following the policy.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets to 27, why, you know, we'll take another look at it. As we've said to the public, it is not at 27. It's less than that, 25, 26 at this point. In most cases, in the school district, class size is 20. The ratio is a number of all teachers divided into the student population.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, there are teachers that are special ed or non-classroom teachers, such as PE and music, that are factored into that ratio. So ratio and class size are two different concepts.
My guest is Michael Johnson. He is the superintendent of the Bexley City School District. If you have a question or comment for him or my other guest, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Mark from Pickerington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to comment. Pickerington recently failed a school levy, and I think the repercussions actually have cost most of the people in Pickerington more out of pocket than if they had passed it. I think it was very short-sighted.
How so? Has it cost them more?
Well, they've increased the pay-to-play for anybody who is in school athletics, and in some cases, things like choir and I believe the orchestra. So if you know they had voted for the levy, anybody who was an athlete wouldn't have had to pay those fees. It was going to be $500 per student per sport. We just heard that it was reduced to, I think, $325 at the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's close to $700 per kid if your kid's a two-sport athlete. They reduced the class. In high school, it was 9 school periods, now 7. So in order to get all your requirements, some kids are having to skip lunch. You know, property values are directly tied to the quality of a district school system. So, I mean, I think a lot of the times the people are very short-sighted in voting no on a school levy.
Okay, Mark, thanks a lot for that call.
Okay.
Mike Jensen, have you had increased things like participation fees for sports and other extracurricular activities and those kind of ancillary costs to families?
There's a participation fee in extracurricular activities. I believe it's $50 at the high school per activity and $25 at the middle school.
So you've kept it pretty low.
Yeah, and we cap it. So, and then, you know, if the family can demonstrate need, we don't charge them.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've tried to keep it as low as possible, and fortunately, we've been able to pass levies, which you know allows the whole community to support the curricular and extracurricular activities.
I read that 82% of your teachers have a master's degree or a higher level of education, and the teaching experience is 16, averages out at 16 years per teacher. I'm not sure. Are those right? Are those accurate about?
Okay. Yeah, yes, we have a high number of our teachers that have master's degrees, and most of them are master's degrees in their content area. So for our teachers to be successful in Bexley, they need to know their content very well, or the students will challenge them to the point that their life would be very frustrating. So,
how can you sustain that? Because teachers with that much experience and teachers with that high level of education, they cost more.
Yeah, they do, but the associated quality of instruction is higher. It's been my experience that if you hire teachers with a level of sophisticated experience and an education, particularly a high level of education in their content area, that translates into successes in the classroom and a higher quality of instruction for the students. So I think the community really expects us to hire the most qualified, the best teachers available out there. And many times we hire teachers with doctorate degrees. We're going to recommend to the Board of Education a person that has public school experience and is coming from South Carolina, is a professor of English. And so we're anticipating that the kind of instruction that particular teacher will deliver is as high level as they would normally receive in college. And most of our kids are going to go to college, so they need to be prepared well, especially in writing, to be successful in that environment.
Jim Siegel, is that atypical? Is that typical? Can every school district afford that? Is it a luxury?
I would say it is. For some districts, it's definitely a luxury to be able to bring in a teacher with that kind of experience and educational background on the ground floor. You know, when you're talking about the salary schedules, there can be a big gap between bringing in a teacher with a few years' experience and bringing in a teacher at what they call level zero on the salary schedule. And it compounds over the years because, you know, if you you're going to pay a teacher a certain amount more at the beginning and then pay them more for the rest of their career as well. So yeah, it's good that for districts that can do that, it's a great thing. Superintendent, I'm wondering your thoughts on teacher the teacher evaluations and requirements that are in there now in this new budget, and you're going to have to put that together. And merit pay, I think, is coming down the road for everyone, even if it's not for you yet.
Merit pay, if it is tied to test scores, there's a lot of research that says that that is not effective. I don't know. I haven't seen research yet that has supported merit pay as a way of increasing test scores. The complexity of the classroom environment and the relationship between teachers and the students, you know, it's not like measuring out and manufacturing widgets. It's a very complex environment. And those studies that have found that the pay is for test scores, tied directly to test scores, the increases in student achievement as a whole child are lower than those school districts that don't use merit pay. But, you know, nonetheless, it's on the table, it's in the law, and we're going to explore and determine the best practices in the area as we've done in other areas in the district.
Abe in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. This the last speaker hit the nail on the head. The budget is one thing, but you know, solving the money of reduced contribution from the state is not difficult compared to what the problem is going to be with the merit pay and evaluation. And that is going to be very expensive. Just the process is going to be very expensive. I think that is where the problem is going to lie. How are the school districts going to develop the merit pay, especially for those places where there are no tests? And it's going to be the budget, the cuts in the amount of money can be handled by reducing staff, by changing the age of the staff, and all those kind of things. The other one is going to be a bigger problem.
And when you say especially where there's no test, you're talking about foreign language, you know, gym art, that kind of thing.
Well, no, but, you know, even at the high school, past the OGT, there is nothing. So how are you going to evaluate teachers who have classes in the junior and senior years? And there's one other big problem with the tests, and that is the students have no investment in it. I actually worked on the 12th grade science exam at one point until it was figured out that it was a waste of money because the students could just blow the test off and it would just reflect badly on the school or on the teacher when that was not the case. At the elementary, it's a little bit easier because kids that age have a tendency to do their best out of pride, which is not what you see in a fair number of teenagers, I suppose.
Because that's what we need to be working on, huh?
Yeah, and so I think they were looking at the wrong thing. I think that the real big problem, and I don't think the legislature knew what they were doing, it just was a fashionable thing to go in there. It's going to be a very, very big and expensive problem to develop the appropriate way of doing merit. It can be done. It's not a bad idea, but hey, people might be ready to pay for it.
Thanks, Abe. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
So the devil's in the details. We have an email from Fred. Mike Johnson, you could answer this question. He asks, what does Governor Kasich mean when he says he wants to see money shifted to the classroom? What's not the classroom? I am assuming the teacher salary and benefits are not the classroom. So what is Kasich talking about? Custodians mopping classroom floors every day instead of once a grade period? Posters for the classroom walls, technology tools for instructions and lessons, textbooks? What does classroom mean?
Well, I'm not sure what he means entirely, but under the current system of budgeting, it's divided into two broad areas, one's for instruction and one's for non-instruction. Teachers could be a teacher that isn't directly involved in the classroom, like a special ed teacher or a teacher that's supporting an elementary teacher so they can get their planning time, and that would be the PE teacher, music, art, so forth. But all of the items I've just explained are considered instructional side portions of the budget. Non-instructional were some of the things that you were pointing to, and that's computers and utilities and custodians, administrators at the school level, secretaries. And there's a food service program, transportation, if there is a transportation system in the school district. So, you know, for every dollar to support all those non-instructional items, feeding the children, transporting the children, supporting them with secretarial and administrative staff, it's usually 45 cents or more. So I think the goal will be to put or address budgeting in such a way that less and less money will be allocated for the purposes of the non-instructional and more to the instructional, which translates in a simple way to the classroom.
Jim Siegel?
And actually, you know, Governor Kasich has said that, you know, as he's crafting his new funding formula, one of the keys is going to be that's going to drive it is this whole idea of putting more money in the classroom. And it will be very interesting to see what he means by that. I mean, because frankly, as the superintendent could attest, I mean, if you just increased all the teacher salaries by 10%, well, there, you've just put more money in the classroom because you've just, you know, you're technically on your books. You're now spending more money on teachers in the classroom.
So how will you show it? How will you account
right,
for
it? Right, but I'm sure that's not what he's talking about. So what are we talking about? And I'm really hoping, because this has not been done, I'm really hoping that the administration or somebody starts pointing to some districts, starts pointing to some real examples of, look, this isn't what we shouldn't be doing anymore. We need to do something different. The problem is when you talk about it all in the abstract, schools are so different, so varying across the state that when you talk about concepts in the abstract, you know, 98% of districts look at that and go, well, that doesn't apply to me. That's not the way things are done here. So they really, I think they need to specify what they're trying to do with this more money in the classroom concept, because it has not been well defined. And I think especially if it's going to drive their new funding formula, they need to say, need to do more here in the next few months to you know, pinpoint what they mean.
Michael Johnson, Bexley City School District's highly successful, no doubt about it. What do you think, though, as an administrator, about the idea of districts merging to save money?
Well, I mean, if it's incentives to involve school districts merging, I think that's that would be an important issue. A lot of school districts exist because they're addressing in some way the community value around education. So if we merge two school districts and we somehow have to merge the values associated with those two school districts, there have been mergers in the past in Ohio. And so, as an example, there could be two different school districts with a K-12 system, and they've merged them, and now they have to decide where the high school is located. In many cases, when one school is closed over another, it has an economic impact on the community that closed its schools. And then I've found, because I've been in other states where I've had to close schools, that these schools actually have an interesting history and almost have a soul to them, because attempting to close schools, people come out and very emotional ways about, well, what are you going to do about my school, the school I graduated from, my children graduated from. But, it's really complex to merge school districts because it's more than bricks and mortar and money. It's the values of the community associated with their educational system. It actually has a very distinct value and culture relative to its educational system. So, I mean, we'd have to overcome those kinds of things if we were wanting to merge with another school district.
Okay. Dr. Michael Johnson, Bexley City School District Superintendent, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it very much.
Coming up, we'll hear from David Varda. He's Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Business Officials, and also Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our daily news loop e-newsletter at wosu.org/email.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of Columbus Zoo Adventures and Jazzu, also growing healthy food in urban food deserts. That's on All Sides with Ann Fisher, Hour 2, beginning at 11 o'clock. And remember that it's easy to renew your membership. You can visit wosu.org/renew to make your contribution for another year. Your online renewal means less paperwork for our station, and that means more of your donation supports the programs you enjoy. And while online, don't forget to set your membership to renew automatically. We can charge your credit card once a year or send you a reminder invoice. It's a quick, easy, and efficient way to show your support and can help reduce on-air fundraising. Visit wosu.org/renew for more information. 74 degrees, sunshine today, and a high reaching up to 82. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 63. Mostly sunny for Friday, another nice day with a high of 85. A few clouds Friday night, a low of 66 degrees. Partly sunny on Saturday, and a high of 87. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about state cuts to public education. Joining us now is David Varda. He's the Executive Director of the Ohio Association of School Business Officials. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And still with us is Jim Siegel. He's Public Affairs Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Jim, thanks for being here today.
Having a good time.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. David, you said that $780 million cut may be better than anyone expected. How so?
Well, I mean, I think that coming in, there were so many unknowns, and, there was a lot of discussion when, the public hears $8 billion. It's hard for them and even my members to get their arms around $8 billion. And when school districts are a large part of the budget, certainly in order to balance, we were fearful of 15-20% cuts. And I think that while districts ended up in those areas, when you take in all of the kind of sources that got cut, there was a great fear it could be more. And then as the process went along, there was money added to K-12. And so some of the initial hits that education was taken in the governor's proposal were softened slightly. Districts still have less money, and they're still going to have to deal with that. But, you know, when you go from March 15th to June 30th, it did improve along the way.
We have an email from James. He writes, I don't know about the regulations here, but in Houston, my wife negotiated a partnership with Caterpillar Corporation to provide a large stipend to her school to make up for budget cuts. So partnerships with local companies might be a possible way to raise funds. Is that allowed in Ohio, David?
Yes, certainly. I think some districts, the district I served for many years, we created our own foundation. Sort of like universities have foundations and everybody. And so if a local business or chamber wanted to partner with us on a program, a specific program or a building program or whatever, certainly the foundation we created was a vehicle to allow that to happen. And I think it goes on a lot in Ohio. Maybe not to the level of maybe a Houston or something like that, but there certainly are a lot of partnering either with citizens in your community or corporations.
Harold in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. My problem with this is I'm not buying any of it. We have a system here that has been described as everything from underperforming to a failure and overexpensive. And I'm trying to figure out how the people who are a product of that system can possibly be wise enough to repair a system that they came out of, first of all.
You're talking about the legislators, right?
Well, the legislators and many of the people that are involved in this are products of the high education system. And I can't figure out if it's that underperforming and if it's that much of a failure and if it's because of money, how you could possibly overlay something like cheap labor and cost reductions and all the rest of this over the top of products of this system and get an outcome that any Ohioan would be happy with.
Okay. Thank you, Harold. David Varda, any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I think that I guess I would not describe the whole Ohio education system as being a failure. I mean, we certainly have districts that are struggling and trying to improve, and there's been a lot of, through the last few governors, starting, you know, with in the 90s with Voinovich Taft and now on through Strickland and Kasich, a lot of attention trying to improve. I think the frustration for the public is that, and sometimes for the people working in the districts, is that with each change in administration and stuff, different tactics and different reforms occur, and it would be nice to settle on a few and really drive them through and decide whether they're the right ones and stuff.
Has the Association of Ohio Association of School Business Officials, have they come out in any way in terms of Senate Bill 5 or the whole issue of how teachers are paid and whether they're overpaid or not, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, we obviously, during the process, well, maybe not obviously, but we did testify both in the House and the Senate in support of parts of Senate Bill 5. There were certainly parts of it that we may have not totally supported, but we were in support of the bill. And, you know, our membership is sort of like the public. It's deeply divided of it. I have members that, are strongly supportive of it. I have members that are not supportive of it, and then they question why we support it. So I think even within our membership, even though we're management, we portray our state in the way this debate has gone on. I mean, I think our consistent position is we are concerned, not necessarily saying teachers are paid more now, but are the compensation models we have in place going to be sustainable in this economic environment in the near future. And I think a lot of us think that the way we pay teachers and the way we pay all of our employees in schools has to change and in order to be able to be sustained. But I don't think we would ever say that we think teachers are overpaid and that purpose should be to reduce that pay. I think it's to be able to sustain it and to keep high, because in the end, I think most researchers agree, the quality of the teacher in the classroom is going to drive the academic achievement of the students, and to be, in order to do that, what are the compensation models you need to have in place to have those people there?
Jim Siegel?
Yeah, I agree. When I hear, when you hear the Kasich administration talk about this and others, I know that the Buckeye Association of School Administrators, which are the superintendents, when they talk about it, sustainability is a big issue because of the way the current salary structures are set up. You know, you get for like, you know, the first 10, 11, 12 years, you get automatic pay increases on top of the increases you get in your negotiated salaries. And then you get more increases for levels of education that you attain. And it's not just you get a bump at a master's degree. I mean, you get a bump in a number of contracts. I mean, you get a bump for 15 hours and you get a bump for 30 more hours and you get a bump for a master's. And it's a master's plus 15 and a master's plus 30. So there's a lot of the schedules can be very broad and they can really increase salaries fairly rapidly. In some districts, I know a couple years ago we looked at this and I mean, you could go from zero to in 10 years, you could double your salary. And you can certainly have an argument about whether or not, you know, teachers are worth that, and that's certainly a debate. But the question I think a lot of people are asking now is, can we afford it, and can it be sustained?
One thing is the issue of education. A lot of districts, we just talked with Michael Johnson of the Bexley City School District, a very high percentage of their teachers have a master's degree or higher. They are just getting ready to hire somebody from South Carolina, I think he said, who's a college professor to teach high school, something in a high school course. I know somebody who works for a private school, a Catholic school, who they don't get the step increases that public teachers get, but the district, or the school system, or this diocese does pay for their college or for their master's degrees. I mean, are there other ways to do this that accomplishes this? Because a lot of people say, "Well, yeah, I need the step increase. I got to pay for a master's degree. It's expensive."
Well, I guess I would answer that. First, you know, more and more there's research coming out to say, you know, does a master's degree better prepare somebody to be a high-quality teacher? I mean, there are, I think, some that would argue maybe it's not as much the degree as important to the ongoing professional development that districts and the state are doing to keep those teachers performing well, and it may, you know, we may start to see a drive away from that kind of salary distinction on a schedule or whatever. But I think that to follow the other part of the point is, yeah, being able to provide professional development, and whether that is through a university system or whatever, may be a way that we recognize good teachers and allow them to pursue what they want to pursue. So.
Okay. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hello, John.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
I'm just listening, and I was engrossed. a couple of things. First of all, I am a former teacher myself, and I am hugely sympathetic. I think there's a lot of complexity in the system, and that's, of course, you know, the local control issue makes things very complex. One of the things that I hear, though, is that, you know, we have to have things that are tailored to our particular school district, or we you know, it has to be so well defined. And I think that's one of the problems that we can sometimes have, is that we're looking for rigidity in process and in, you know, structure and all that kind of thing, and we're trying to impose that, and it's just not going to work. I get, for example, I'm a huge believer in pay for performance. Organizations do this all the time with jobs that are very, very, very different across the organization, and they're still able to make it work. So when I hear people say, well, we couldn't possibly do paper performance because these rural teachers are so different from urban teachers, are so different from, you know, K through 12, or, you know, high school versus under
elementary,
junior high, elementary, et cetera. And so to me, I question whether or not there is a larger kind of philosophical assumption that it has to be a certain way. And if we could get past that, if we could say, look, we're going to hire people that are passionate about teaching, that want to be there to teach, and then we're going to have some parameters that how we operationalize within those parameters. We're allowed the districts to do that, but we're still going to have some consistency here and some basic things that can work. The bottom line is pay for performance works in very complex organizations with wildly different jobs, and I believe that it could work in public education very well as well.
David Barta, thank you for that call. John?
I think that's a very, he made some very interesting points. I do think that, you know, figuring out a way to reward performance is something that we're going to have to be about trying to do. I think part of the issue is that, which I think John also pointed out, was that we seem to always, we have 614 school districts in the state of Ohio. We have we're all across the wealth and non-wealth, and we continue to try to have a fix that does well in all 614 school districts, and that's part of maybe we need to, either whether it's a funding system or performance, say it's okay to discriminate because kids are different and they have different needs. The other issue, I think, though, on performance is, you know, who is influencing the performance of that child? And what I mean is, in the district I served for so long, we had a lot, we spent money and intervention services and guidance counseling services and stuff that we really believed help our children be better in the classroom. Well, if you put a system together for performance and a teacher is doing great with a classroom, who's going to get credit for that? And is it going to be just the classroom teacher, or is it going to be a combination? Because we had three intervention teachers in there that really got the low-performing kids up to speed. And I think that's where the complication comes in. I'm a big sports addict, and, you know, I mean, it's sort of like football. I always say the quarterback gets too much credit and too much blame, and sometimes maybe the classroom teacher is getting too much credit and too much blame. And so that's where I think the complication comes in.
David Barta, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me. Always be nice to be on the same program with Jim.
It's David Barta. He's executive director of the Ohio Association of Business Officials. Also, Jim Siegel, thanks for joining us, Jim, again.
Yes, it's good to be here.
Jim Siegel, he's public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Just want to tell people that we're going to be having a show on merit pay very, very soon. So I hope you'll be listening then. Thanks for listening now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.